You are about to participate in the most ambitious culinary experiment ever imagined.
This competition is going to test everything.
Adapt quickly to anything. I mean anything. The wildest day of your life starts right now.
All new 24 and 24 Last Chef Standing. Sunday night at 8 on Food Network. Stream on Max.
I'm very happy to be talking about the infant kiss because it holds a really huge place in my heart as probably her, my favorite vocal performance of hers in her entire body of work. And it's probably my second favorite song on this album after Breathing. And I love this album. This is my third favorite album of all time. So that means I love it a lot. And it's also an extremely complex song with a very rich history and backstory. And even if it didn't have that, it's just really fascinating as a piece of vocal work and musical work.
Welcome to Strange Phenomena, the music of Kate Bush. I am Cecily Link, and this week we are going to be talking about the eighth track from Kate Bush's third album, Never Forever, called The Infant Kiss.
I say goodnight, night. I took him in tight.
With me to talk about the song this week.
Hi, I'm Zoe. I've been on a bunch of other episodes. I was last on the wedding list. I'm very happy to be talking about The Infant Kiss because it holds a really huge place in my heart as probably her, my favorite vocal performance of hers in her entire body of work. And it's probably my second favorite song on this album after Breathing. And I love this album. This is my third favorite album of all time. So that means I love it a lot. And it's also an extremely complex song with a very rich history and backstory. And even if it didn't have that, it's just really fascinating as a piece of vocal work and musical work.
So speaking of the story behind the song, so let's get into the story. I mean, of course, this was written for her third album, Never Forever, but it is one of those songs that is based on a movie, which in turn was also based on a story.
Novella. What's gonna get fancy English major with it.
So this was based on the movie The Innocents, which in turn was based on the story The Turn of the Screw, neither of which I have either seen or read. I've heard of The Turn of the Screw, but that was one of those AP English stories that I didn't get to because I wasn't in AP English in high school, but I'd always heard of it. But
you're missing out.
I that's what I hear. I hear it's quite a creepy story. Like I read about it a little bit I read about the plot summary for this episode, but I know you know more about a little bit more about this subject matter than I do. So tell us a little bit more, like what is The Turn of the Screw about, and also this movie, The Innocents. You're familiar with this here. So tell us, what is all this about?
I'm familiar with both. So the thing is, Seth and I, before we started this recording, were saying that what makes this song kind of unique in her body of work, well, this is not unique in the sense that it's a story song, but it is unique in the sense that it pretty much makes no sense without the context of The Innocents and The Turn of the Screw, particularly The Innocents. And that, because if you just hear this song, it sounds like it's about pedophilia. And I know people who find it disgusting, who don't like to listen to it. They find it uncomfortable, and I think that's totally valid. The thing is, it's actually based on a story that isn't exactly about I'll go more into it, but it's actually about a ghost story that seems pedophilic. So I was an English major, like focusing in literary studies and literary analysis, and my mentor and advisor at school is actually a Henry James scholar, and Henry James, the author, turned the screw. So there has been literally at this point now, like a century.
Yeah.
The screw came out in 1898, but there have been decades and decades, especially in like the early 20th century, decades of controversy and debate over certain subtexts of the story. And Kate, in this song, makes that subtext very explicit. So this song is actually really interesting from a literary criticism standpoint, because she's kind of like taking sides on a big literary debate that's been going on for decades, almost a century now. But anyways, so the content is very disturbing. It sounds on the surface like it's about a governess who's in love with her little boy that she's the governess for. Mm-hmm. And so what I remember in Under the Ivy, the biography on her by Graham Thompson, he made a really fascinating note that he said that it's the reverse of the man with the child in his eyes. Mm-hmm. It's the child with the man in his eyes, which is true. And so go into it. So Turn the Screw is published in 1898. It's like a novella, probably 90 pages. I highly recommend reading it. Henry James is like the most verbose, wordy author ever. But this particular novella is more accessible to read as opposed to his things where he'll have like a paragraph long sentence. It's legitimately scary. I remember when I read it in college, I was actually scared while reading it. So basically it's about a governess who goes to take care of these two children. The little boy's named Miles. I don't remember the little girl's name. And so she comes to either, depending on your point of view and how you read the story, she either comes to realize or she comes to believe, because she is herself insane, that the two young children are possessed by the spirits of two former employees who are adults. So the story the way that Henry James writes it is very subjective. It's completely in her head, and she's a very classic Poor as a daughter, fancy. So she's a classic unreliable narrator. She also doesn't have a name, which makes the book even more subjective, and you're very much just in her head, kind of stream of consciousness. So one quote from Wikipedia is that many critics have wondered if the strange and sinister elements are only in the governess's mind and part of reality. The result has been a long-standing critical dispute about the reality of the ghost and the sanity of the governess. Beyond the dispute, critics have closely examined James's narrative technique. The framing introduction and first-person narrative by the governess have been studied by theorists of fiction interested in the power of fictional narratives to convince or even manipulate readers. So The Turn of the Screw is not just a good, scary story. It's also a fascinating psychological story about where, when you're reading it, like I remember when we read it in class, basically I had a really fun, very blunt, fun teacher. So he comes up and the class says, "So how many of you think she's crazy?" And because basically it's like either you're reading it, you think she's making this all up, or it's an actual ghost story, and you don't know how to interpret it. Oh. So in 1961, it was adapted into a movie. So there's a subtext in it. I don't know. There's a subtext that she seems very fascinated by the little boy who is possessed by the spirit of a man. And so some literary critics, particularly psychoanalytic literary critics, because they see sex everywhere, have believed that the governess is in love with Miles. So it was adapted into a movie in 1961 called The Innocents. In that, they give the narrator a name, so it's less subjective. It's also, since it's not a book, you're not reading it literally, you're not reading her thoughts. Mm-hmm. So what this kind of debate of is she kind of in love with Miles is made quite explicit in the final scene, which this song gets its name from, The Infant Kiss. The final shot is of the governess. I don't remember what happens, but like ghostly stuff happens, and the governess kisses Miles. If you Google The Innocents ending on YouTube, it's there. I listened to it last night. She kisses him in a way that, like, honestly looks like they're making out. It's pretty sexualized. And so it makes that implicit sexual content explicit. And so in both the book and the movie, she dies in his arms. But in the book, she does not kiss him on the lips. So it's interesting because the movie, which stars Deborah Kerr as the governess, kind of for people who believe that she's actually crazy and that she's in love with him, for that school of thought, it kind of proves what they've implied for decades, that the latent sexuality. The way I see it is that the innocence is kind of one interpretation of Turn of the Screw, and it can still be interpreted differently. Mm-hmm. She isn't necessarily in love with him, but the way that Kate Bush clearly watched the movie was seeing it that way, was seeing it as a governess who is very conflicted over her emotions about this young boy who is actually possessed by a man, which is still disturbing because, I mean, if you watch the movie, he's a little boy. Like, mm-hmm. he doesn't appear to her as a man. He's a little boy. But it's just interesting because it's way more ambiguous in the book. And even within the movie, you're wondering whether this is in her head or whether it's real. But this kind of sexual thing between her and the boy isn't really a big deal to the final infant kiss, where she's kissing him. I remember watching it and being like, they're making out. I mean, he's dying in her arms, so he's not really that participatory in it, but it's pretty sexualized. So that's the backstory. The backstory is basically she wrote this song about the governess falling in love with a child who is possessed by a grown-up. So she's essentially falling in love with the adult who's mm-hmm. possessing the child. So it's not straightforward pedophilia, but it's still mm-hmm. pedophilic.
Yeah, it definitely, if you read the lyrics just as they are, I'm looking at here on Google. What's interesting is like that she's singing this from the point of view of a woman singing about, where the way it looks, that she's singing about a little boy. But can you imagine the uproar if it had been a guy singing about a little girl like this?
Yeah, I mean, it'd be horrifying. I mean, it's weird, but the thing is, I wonder if it was, like, based on a similar... But also, I was going to say maybe not if it was also the case where it was based on a source where that's what the story was about, but mm-hmm. they're also... I can't think, like, that's, like, I guess, Lolita? Yeah, like, people writing songs.
Yeah.
That's
really what I was thinking, like, Lolita.
Honestly, it's, like, so normalized in pop culture in a way. Like, mm-hmm. a man singing out a younger woman is pretty normal, but not in a way where she's saying, just a kid and just at school, back home, they call me dirty. But there's definitely so there. I feel like I've heard a lot of songs of men being like, oh, I'm so into this girl and she's so hot. I feel like a man almost couldn't have written this song because it's so much. She's writing it as a ghost story. It's like, it's a sex story. It's a sexual story, but it's more about the inner conflict rather than the desire, and not to stereotype all men, but I feel like songs by men about women tend to just be more about the desire rather mm-hmm. than like any conflict about the desire.
That is true. The conflict over whether to start a relationship doesn't really come up in pop music at all.
Should I feel guilty about this? I don't know. Should I ask for consent? Not a lot of songs about consent Mm-mm. on the top 40.
Or good. Any of the rap songs that get blasted around where I live. Oh, yeah.
Or rock. I mean, plenty of people sing about rap, but rock, like metal and rock is just misogynistic. So, but yeah, but this is a fast, we can dig more into the lyrics later, but because there are some lyrics that I really love and some lyrics that make me go, ooh.
So, and yeah, I've got a couple too. Yeah, and I've got a couple too that I'm like, yeah, this is pretty cool. Yeah. So the song itself, like, is pretty, it's kind of a simple song, really. I mean, there's some guitar, there's a lot of strings, and there's also something, it's called a lyrinae, which is a bass member of the lyra family of instruments that was popular in the late 16th and early 17th century. It's a bowed string instrument, and when played, you play it like a cello or a viol, which is very similar to a viola. I'm not a big orchestra. I was a band geek. I played clarinet, but I still find like all these different stringed instruments fascinating. And it's neat that she used these different kind of stringed instruments on the song. And it sounds nice and rich as she's singing under her.
Yes, and it's funny, because funny is not a simple song, because it is, but also is it so intense, and that's why I love it so much. And the strings make it so intense. Just the strings just keep building and building and building, and it's just it builds the tension until the very end when the backing vocals scream "Get too much" along with her, and it's this huge climax. So just this mounting tension that where the music completely parallels the psychological tension happening within her, that makes this song extremely powerful for me, and that's why I love it so much. It's just it's pure gothic, straight up gothic tension. Mm-hmm. Right? It's a very gothic song. Not gothic as in goth, gothic as in like capital G gothic. I cannot sit and let something happen now, regret. Ooh, he scares me. There's an end behind those eyes. I catch him when I'm bending. Ooh, how he frightens me when they whisper privately. Could be waiting, close me. Words of courage on their lips. Speak of an of love. I want to smack it.
It's also, I'm looking at the sheet music here for it from Kate Bush, the complete Kate Bush, and the chord progression alone is it. I'm looking at these going, whoa, you got these. No wonder she did a great job with the chords that she played in this song, because there's a lot of tension in the chords that she chose. Like, she's got a lot of chords that, like I mentioned in other songs, that are against each other you wouldn't usually have. Mm-hmm. Like, she's got, for the "What Is This, an Infant Kiss," she goes from a D to a C sharp, so it's like you're descending a little bit, and you wouldn't usually have those chords with each other. It's really neat how she used these chords to help create that tension.
Yeah, you had some good quotes of things she said about the song, because again, it's interesting that she kind of has this song on an album, and in interviews she explains the context, but unless you're being interviewed, you're just like, okay.
Yeah. Like, here, this first one was from an interview. This was from the Never Forever debut. I need to look up exactly where that came from, because I know I got it from Gaffa and where all that. I think it was a radio interview that she did in October of 1980, where she was just like talking about the songs. And she says, "I don't know if anyone's seen a film called The Innocents. It initially inspired it. It's an old British film, a very haunting film about a governess who goes to stay and look after two children, a young boy and a young girl. And unknown to her, they're both possessed by the spirit that lived in there before, like the gardener and a maid. And particularly, the boy is in a very, very heavy possession state. He has a, like, 32-year-old man inside him as a spirit. And the governess will go to give him a little kiss goodnight, and he suddenly gives her a very big, passionate kiss. And the song is about the woman being incredibly torn. She doesn't know what's happening, because there's this really sweet little boy that she loves maternally, and yet through his eyes there's coming this really wicked, lusty man. And so she can't work out what's happening. She thinks she's going mad, when in fact there is this terrible evil force in such a young child that could never have this experience through his own age. And so she's just freaking out, saying, 'My God, what's happening?' And the green interviewer is like, 'Yeah.' And she says, 'And it was a distortion that I myself would find terribly disturbing.' And me.
I really
love distortions."
Yeah, which that is her saying, "I really love distortions," but not so much like her entire career and her entire body of work. Yeah. It's interesting how she just, the way that she, that's her, to see her view on the movie and seeing it as like something so erotically charged, as opposed to a ghost. I mean, it is a ghost story to her, but also a ghost story. Yeah, she's basically like a lot of literary critics I read around the time I read The Turner's Screw, who are like, "Sex, sex, sex."
And she also says in the Kate Bush News Club newsletter, she says, "The Infant Kiss is about a governess. She is torn between the love of an adult man and a child who are within the same body." And then there's it's kind of long here, this second interview, which came from a 1985 issue of Hot Press. The interviewer says that there are other areas where you've specifically taken a taboo as a theme. For example, the infant kiss. And she says, "Yes, that was fascinating. It was based on the film The Innocents. I saw it years ago when I was very young, and it scared me. And when films scare you as a kid, I think they really hang there. Oh, yeah. As a side note, can totally relate to that. It's a beautiful film, quite extraordinary. This governess is supposed to look after these children, a little boy and a girl, and they're actually possessed by the spirits of the people who were in the house before, and they keep appearing to the children. It's really scary, as scary on some levels as the idea of The Exorcist, and that terrified me. The idea of this young girl speaking and behaving like she did was very disturbing, very distorted. But I quite like that song. And the interviewer says, but there are those who would say it was totally perverse. And she says, I suppose they would. But actually, I don't think I could find a younger man attractive, let alone a boy. But the whole idea of looking at a little innocent boy in that distortion, I mean, it's absolutely terrifying, isn't it? I thought it was ingenious, great, so weird and natural. And the interviewer says, but the thing is, looking at it objectively, that's a song about pedophilia. The strange thing is that written by a woman, that seems acceptable. She says, it's very different from a woman's point of view, and I think that's also what's so interesting about it. But did it occur to you that if the song had been written and sung by a man, there might have been a really huge outcry? That's something I never thought about, but I suppose you're right. But a man didn't write it. I don't know, it's a bit hard to understand, but it was the fascination of a very soft, gentle woman who wouldn't consider herself perverse at all. In fact, she wasn't, that's the thing. She thought she was being a petta thingy.
So she said a petta thingy. She was torn the word a petta thingy.
But in fact, she wasn't. She was truly picking up a real man's energy and not a kid's, because the child was possessed. It's very different if it involves a man and a little girl. The man is so powerful to start with.
Yeah, and you see this turmoil in the lyrics between where she's torn between being a good woman and being bad, and being, quote unquote, bad, to that home, they call me dirty, all my barriers are going, especially considering that both the film and the book are in the Victorian era, where there's even more emphasis than there was in 1980 on being the proper woman.
Yeah.
That this song is very much about, like letting the id take over the ego and superego, pretty much.
And then the interview says, I was thinking of it on a political level, say, how would feminists react if I wrote that song? She says, yes, if you wrote that song, automatically it would have some weird and dangerous connotations. Because you don't normally think, and this is very heavy, this, when there are attractions to children from adults, you normally do think of it as men to girls. It's just more spoken of. And I think you're into very negative, dangerous areas that would make it something very unpleasant.
Foreshadowing for Ralph Harris. But the thing is, it's not about an adult attracted to a child.
Yeah.
It's a ghost story. So that's what I think distinguishes it. I think that, again, like, I'm just biased because I'd already was very familiar with the material before I'd ever listened to Kate Bush. And I didn't know when I listened to it that it was based on it, but I think I just loved the sound of the song so much. And then I researched everything I could ever learn about her and learned that it would be dangerous if it were about being attracted to children. But it's not a song about being attracted to children. It's a song about being attracted to a ghost and the turmoil of that creates within this woman's psychology.
I will admit this was not a favorite to start with, but the more I dig into the song and more I realize the story that she's telling a story, I like it. I mean, it continues her penchant for singing about topics that can be very uncomfortable. And
yeah.
I do love her vocals. For me, I like the leaps when she's leaping on let go, and then having those those angelic ahs that lead into Night Send It Stock. I mean, you wrote it there, and that was what I was thinking too.
Let's go, let's go.
I just love when she's leaping around in the melody. It makes it very Broadway. It feels very much like a character. Like you are privy to this woman's thoughts. Like she's turned to the audience and she's having this moment. And
it kind of, yeah, it kind of sounds like as if The Innocents was made for a musical, and there's this is like a musical number from it.
Yeah. And it's, I mean, it's got the traveling chord progression that's usually in a lot of theater songs. It's got the big leaps in melody that you don't find outside of musical theater. And it sounds beautiful. It really does. And when she's singing this in French, which we'll get into, it sounds even prettier because it's French. I mean, come on.
Yeah, this song is very musical theater, so I understand why people wouldn't like it. I mean, the same reason that people don't like a lot of Lionheart, you know, I mean, who likes musical theater? Like
yeah.
Dorky girls and gay guys. But as you mentioned, the Oz in the back, when she says, let go, the song ends with her saying, all my fairies are going, it's starting to show, let go. And then the background, there's these ha's, and it's really beautiful and kind of represents that her impulses have taken over, that she isn't able to control herself. And then it leads into Night Sense and stuff very beautifully. And I really love the very end of the song. There's a little, this might be that weird instrument or the name that you, what it was called, but that type of string instrument where there's a noise and goes, do, 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 do. It's very creepy, these last few notes, very unsettling, creepy ending. I just absolutely adore it as someone who loves all things spooky and gothic. But yeah, those ahs followed by do, 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 do just kind of give a sense of like the ghost completely taken over.
Mm-hmm. I do have to wonder, I mean, I've already kind of recorded a little brief thing about Night Sentence Talk. By the way, that episode's going to be like 9 minutes and 45 seconds. I wanted it to at least be under 10 minutes. But I do have to wonder, like, why she has this leading into Night Sentence Talk, which I was kind of like, not real sure why.
I feel like it works very well because you have the Diva, you have the Diva Trilogy, three songs, mm-hmm. with The Wedding List, Violin, and Infant Kiss, which are pretty much completely over the top. And then that the Oz kind of then bring you down into Army Dreamers. So Army Dreamers is a much calmer, so as with mm-hmm. the waltz tempo and just the style of the song is way, I think it's kind of just like taking a breath, a much needed breath. Like I think it's really important and nice bridge in the song, in the album. Because this song is just so, as we said, so tense. It's unbearably mm-hmm. tense and builds so much tension that you have then like 30 seconds of just release, then Army Dreamers, which is also more low-key, and then goes into Breathing, which is just, I mean, that song contains multitudes and is like an worthy of an entire album's worth exploration on its own.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that you need, after having three songs in a row as intense as The Wedding List, Violin, and The Instant Kiss, you need to take a breath.
Very true. I could see that. Because it is very calming. It's like 52 seconds of just her like, It's very true.
Yeah, but like kind of without that, it's like if you just have The Instant Kiss go into RPG, I just feel like those three, the Diva Trilogy, what I always call the Diva Trilogy, are just so intense that you need some kind of come down. Like, I personally like albums in general where not every song has the same range of intensity, like where mm-hmm. you'll have kind of peak, like goes up and down. So I think she kind of needed to bring it down a little bit in order for the listener to reacclimate and readjust and be able to like actually pay enough attention to Army Dreamers and Breathing.
Mm-hmm. So for you, yeah, but you've got the Diva Trilogy. You were kind of digging a little bit on here.
Yeah, and what I've noticed, what I was thinking about, is that with these, you know, these lyrics, all my bears are going, starting to show. So she's this song is about the turmoil in regards to losing self-control. And something I only just realized is with the Diva Trilogy, there's really a connection with all three songs in that. So The Wedding List, as we talked about in interviews, she said that it was about when revenge takes over you. and being overtaken by revenge. And then Violin is kind of being overtaken by the wildness of the violin, the wildness of as what she calls the banshees, you know, the music. And then this song is about being overcome by forbidden desire. So I feel like you have these three extremely intense songs, both musically and lyrically, about being overwhelmed by something inside yourself that you can't control or something out. And then again, so that's why it's nice to have a little breath after with Night Senses Stuff. As of my second favorite on the album, probably. I mean, it's hard to say because I really love this album, but just something I just have my whole life have loved anything that is spooky and supernatural and gothic. So this song, even without knowing the context, just the sound of it with the mounting strings and the tension plays into that, as well as just it's my favorite vocal performance of hers ever. And that's saying a lot because I'm such a huge fan and there are so many vocal songs that she performs flawlessly, but something about her vocals in this song just my absolute favorite. It has also my favorite vocal moment of her entire career. Mentioned it in the intro, but when she has no control, the way that she makes the word no into like an entirely different language, basically, that is my favorite vocal moment in her entire career. No control. Totally, but she does it a few times, even like, but things are not right. Like, she just goes through so many different notes within a few syllables in this song. And it really just, it sends me, as they say. I feel like I'm like being sent to the heavens or something. So the strings that build the tension and tension builds, then get too much. Just, it breaks. And I think it's just the way that the backing vocals are used in that way as kind of, the backing vocals are her it, are kind of the things that she's trying to suppress. And then eventually it takes over. And she can't control it anymore. And the way she uses the backing vocals that way to me is brilliant. And again, I like that it's based on her character having a moment. It had soft spot for me, the Henry James reference. I'm a Henry James fan. And yeah, so I just love this song. So just something about it, just, I'll just say it touches my heart, but there's a lyric that says, his whole hand is on my heart. So I understand why people don't feel comfortable listening to it, for sure. And I think it's valid. But I think that considering what it's actually about, like a ghost story, before Michigan Psy came out, she wrote over 100 songs, so she's had plenty of material. So it's interesting that she's like, this is what I'm going to put on my album, and then that becomes the first number one album by a female soul artist in Britain. You know, it's just interesting that of all the things to be on a pop, like, this is not a pop song. It's not a pop song, and in terms not just the content but also the structure. So I think it's just a really fascinating choice for her to include. I mean, I think there's a lot of things with this album that are extremely experimental and not pop. Delius, the breathing, and this as well are just, she's really going somewhere different that isn't pop and that are really, to be honest, like corny theater kid music in the sense of this song. But I just absolutely adore the drama. The thing is, I like music as dramatic as possible. For example, both you and I are big fans of Florence and the Machine. My favorite album of hers. Woo! And my favorite album of hers, Ceremonials, because it just is so dramatic. Like, literally, it's just like banger after banger after banger, drama, and every song has to do with ghosts and like spirit and like spooky shit. Beginning, so she says, when she says, I say goodnight, night, the way she says it is very, I don't want to say shrill because that's used in such a pejorative way often, but it kind of, it's the type of thing where if you put this song on, someone will, it's kind of like when you put Wuthering Heights and someone's like, oh my gosh, what is that? It's kind of the same reaction where it's like, oh, that's a very high note. Okay, wow. Because there are other times, for example, Delius, think her vocals are more, I mean, she does go to the really high at the end, but it doesn't start out, even Babushka, she starts out in more of a neutral playing ground, but here she's starting out so high. I say goodnight, night. I took him in tight, but things are not right. again, it just really takes you aback. And then I like the what is this, infant kiss, just the way the strings kick in there is really amazing. And then when mm-hmm. she says, I've never fallen for a little boy before, it's like, oh, well, I hope not.
Yeah, I know.
Yeah, and then there goes the classic no control, my favorite moment mm. ever. And then says, just a kid, just a school, at home they'd call me dirty. I love how she says dirty. With her British accent.
I know. And part of what I like about Kate is that she lets her English accent through. Like, she doesn't go, no, I'm going to make it, you know, I'm going to like neutralize my accent. No. If there's an R in the word, I'm not going to pronounce it. Dutty. So,
yeah.
I like that too.
Yeah. And yeah. And then I like his, then the next part, his little hand is on my heart. He's got me where it hurts me. I like that. I think that's pretty poetic. Then she has knock, knock, who's there in this baby? You know how to work me. Mm. So as you mentioned, great book. When she's, you know how, I mean, I'm not going to try.
Yeah, like it's this like
her.
Yelpy thing.
I love
thing.
It vocally.
Yeah, this little yelpy thing yeah. she does, you know how to work. Like she's like doing a lot of stuff with like forcing air through and like, how to work me, like, kind
of
like that.
It's a it's the type of thing where I'm listening to my iPod, because I'm old person, so my iPod, not my phone. I'll like scroll back and re-listen to that line, because I love what she does vocally there. But but the lyric itself is a little, it kind of throws you into 1980 for a little bit for me, where like that's like some, it's that almost sounds like something a dude is right, like, oh, she knows how to work me, baby, you know? Mm-hmm. It's kind of profane and not ethereal in like the sense of like the ghost story element of this song kind of should be. Yeah. But she does it vocally so well. And then I like, all my barriers are going, it's starting to show, because that's, you know, the turmoil that she's talking about in regarding losing self-control. And then it's interesting when she says, I cannot sit and let something happen I'll regret. Oh, he scares me. Because she's struggling, it seems, in this song with her own desire and how act and if she should act on her own desire. But here she's more passive, saying, I cannot sit and let something happen I'll regret. As if, well, I mean, in the story, she's concerned that in the context of the story, the concern is that the ghosts are going to kill the children, which they kind of does in the end when that's just, she kisses him like when he's dead. But yet interesting, because it seems like this song is that someone wrestling with their own inner demons, but now she's talking out like someone else acting upon other people or upon her. And it is a story about a governess trying to protect the children, but she doesn't really seem to interpret it that way in her lyrics. But then suddenly for like two lines she does. I cannot sit and
Well, it sounds like, I mean, because this is supposed to be about somebody who's very conflicted, and I can see that where you were just saying that, well, it sounds like one thing, but then she's got two lines here, they've taken it in a different direction, and
Yeah, and then she says, there's a man behind those eyes. So there we go with the man with the child behind his eyes. The man with the child in his eyes. Yeah, and I also, after something happens, I'll regret, one of my other favorite moments is, ooh, he scares me. It's the same thing she does on No Control. She with the No Control, she repeats that in Things Are Not Right, the No Control, and Oh, He Scares Me. So that's kind of like a vocal pattern she repeats three times in that. And it's just such a brilliant I haven't really heard anyone do anything like that before in any other song.
Mm-hmm.
It's just A plus vocal delivery on that. Oh, he scares me.
Yeah, she hits a nice high F sharp on there. I was looking at the sheet music here, and because it's just so pretty. I love it when she sings high like that. Yay!
Well, the thing is, I wouldn't call it pretty. I think it's more like startling, you know, which goes with the song really well. Like, this is a song that I feel is very, even if it had totally different lyrics and it was just different lyrics, you're singing it the same way. It was still very polarizing, almost in the same way that Wuthering Heights is polarizing, just because it's so vocally over the top and extreme. That's the kind of thing where, like, only musical theater nerds are going to like, kind of. And yeah, some other lyrics, just silly, but when she says, I want to smack, but I hold back, I only want to touch. I don't know, that something about that line makes me laugh. I don't know. It's something silly about it.
Actually, I kind of chuckle at that line too as well.
Yeah, it's interesting when she says, I catch him when I'm bending. There's a man behind those eyes, I catch him when I'm bending. So I just picture, like, you know, Legally Blonde, like the bend and snap.
Oh, and, yes, like, I think of that too.
I always feel like her literally bent over, like, and, like, is he, like, watching her butt? Like, it just obviously makes me, like, silly. I'm silly. And those eyes, I catch
him when I'm bending. No, I thought of that too, like, bend and snap. Bend and snap.
Yeah. Anyway. But it's interesting. It's like she's noticing him watching her. She gets attracted to him while she's bent over. It's like, because is he watching her bent over? It's that very sexual.
Yeah, never thought of that. Yeah.
You know, that I want to smack, but I hold back. Like, does she want to smack the governess or, like, smack? To smack, but I hold back. Sorry, I don't mean to joke about pedophilia. I really, really do not. I'm a social worker. I work with children. I promise. I'm not joking. It's not a laughing matter to me.
Yep. I totally. Yep. I got it. Yeah, there are a couple of other. So I'm just looking at the. I too like that. His little hand is on my heart for some reason. Mm-hmm. That line sticks out to me as well. And the other, there's a man behind those eyes. Like you said, makes you think of the man with the child in his eyes, but it's the child with the man in his eyes. Wendy Whaley blows me. I find it to be an interesting line.
Yeah, I thought interesting too, because I also didn't know she was saying that for really long. That's one
me
of those classic Kate Bush moments where you have no idea what she's saying, you just go with it.
Oh yeah.
But I'm like, oh, okay, that's, and also the words of caress on their lips, they speak of adult love. I didn't know she was saying that until quite recently. That's okay, whatever, it's just fun with it. Words of caress on their lips,
speak of adult love. Yeah, I didn't know either.
So, but whose lips also? So it's like, is it, I'm presuming based on the source material that it's the children's lips that are speaking of adult love, which is interesting.
Like the whole, oh, this is a kid, but they're doing something that I don't expect them to do, that I don't know, like a kid, it almost in a way like a little kid, you hear a little kid drop a bunch of F-bombs or something like that, and you're just kind of like, what, huh? Excuse me, what is that coming out of your mouth? What?
Well, I mean, it's about two children who are, depending on how you interpret it, possessed by the spirits of two adults, or that she believes, because she is going mad herself, are possessed by spirits of two adults. So that's how I would interpret it. But it's but that creates a lot of the Windy Whales, words of caress, definitely very atmospheric.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm not quite.
But not really, what I love about this song is just like the music, like the musical composition and how tense and extra and dramatic it is. Just all the things that I love about her that people who hate her hate about her. Like, for example, so I mentioned that my college, like, mentor and favorite professor, the Henry James Scholar, she actually said to me that listening to Kate, said Kate Bush, quote, hurts my ears. But I respect that and understand it, because she's into, like, really, like, deep blues music. So you're not going to be into Kate Bush if you're into that. So this is exactly the type of song where if Kate Bush hurts her ears, this is, like, the type of song where you'll be like, oh, God, that wailing harpy.
And that's what I like too. Because this is still at her, the point of her career where she's still sounding, where her vocal tone is still sounding a little bit young, but it's starting to get a little bit more muscular, like what she would definitely start doing on The Dreaming. And I like that. I like her, you know, y'all think it's shrill. I think it's cool. I mean, come on.
Yeah. And I don't think that, yes, it's shrill, but to me, that's not a bad thing. To me, that's an interesting thing, and a good thing. And what I think is really perfectly captured in this song is this is such a perfect moment where her voice still has the best of both worlds.
Mm-hmm.
Of having the kind of growing maturity where she is Broadway diva. Like, this is, I feel like the kind of Broadway diva element of this song is something that you don't hear vocally on the Kicking side. Like, mm-hmm. Her voice is still really wonderful and has amazing range there, but it's just, you don't get that Broadway diva sense that you get here. And at this point, it's developed into that, but still retains the range and high pitch of the Kicking side and Lionheart. So I really like that it's a marriage of different vocal styles.
And speaking of different vocal styles, so in the French version that she released of this song a couple years later as a B-side for Ne t'en fuis pas, her voice, I can tell that in just the 2 years since this album, since this version was released and then the French version, that her voice, she's still hitting the same high notes for sure. But her voice sounds like deeper somehow, and especially on the French version on Le Baiser d'Enfant, which literally means the infant kiss.
Yeah, it's interesting because it does sound deeper, but also when I listened to the French version, I do feel like she does hit the same high notes just as successfully. So I'm kind of like, oh, it's a shame she's still clearly capable of doing, and she does on The Dreaming, she does some really amazing high notes, she does, but like, then it's like, oh, well, if she was still able to do it, she still should have kept on doing it, you know, like,
yeah,
you know, but that's just because I'm partial to her early vocals, but if there's moments in the French version, I find it, so I think also why I thought it sounded more high-pitched than you did is because I thought she sounded more frightened in this version as well.
Oh, I agree.
And that might be because she's singing in a language that she doesn't know and is being said the words. So that might be why she sounds scared. But I think she sounds more genuinely scared in this. But like in the infant kiss, in the English version, there's so much passion in the lyrics and tension. But this sounds, in the French version, it sounds more like fear almost. It's goofy, like fear of herself and fear of what's happening.
Yeah, she's definitely got more vibrato.
Kind of pitch higher.
Yeah, and she's definitely got like more vibrato when she's singing, where it's kind of like she's trembling
later on.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, she does that in general later on, like when she redid Wuthering Heights, the like version number two, it's more vibrato-y. I mean, it's more clear and sharp, but also more like vibrato. Yeah, she tends to do that later on.
Yeah. of war. Yeah, the French version had French lyrics that she didn't write. It was my understanding that she took French classes, but not enough to write a song in it. But the French lyrics were by François Cahan. Looks like Cahan. I'm saying it like in French. François Cahan. And he, I cannot find anything about him except that he wrote lyrics for this song. So I don't know who this François is. It was recorded in one day by Kate Del Palmer and Paul Hardiman on October 16th, 1982. So not long after The Dreaming was released. Interesting. And it was released as the B-side for Ne T'en Fuis Pas and on the Canadian-US mini LP Kate Bush. And it was my understanding that they were trying to break Kate into the Canadian market, and that's part of why she decided why they had her do songs in French. Why this particular one, you and I both, like, I'm like, seriously, why this one? Pourquoi? You
know? I mean, I love this song. As I said, second favorite song, one of my top 10 Kate Bush songs of all time. But, like, to be like, okay, just made after Dreaming, you have four albums. Which one of these are we going to release? You have, let's say each song has albums, 10 songs. We have 40 songs to them. Which one, like, maybe will we translate The Man with the Child Wounds Eyes, something more palatable? No, we're going to go with the one that sounds like it's about pedophilia, unless you know about the very complex backstory. Mm-hmm. So, I don't mind that she translated into French because I love this song, but from a marketing perspective and a business perspective, it does not make very much sense.
No.
She had just had chosen a bit of all of her songs. I mean, she has so many songs to choose from, and to make this the one that you release as a single to break into other markets.
Yeah.
But she is bigger in Canada than she is in America. Mm. So.
And the French lyrics, they're a basic translation of the English lyrics, except that they slightly tweaked some of the lines so that there could be like a clear rhyme scheme. I know, like, the first two lines, je dis bonne nuit, je le bon dans mon lit, mais ça ne veut pas, that's basically, I say good night, I put him into bed, but things aren't well, what is this, a kiss that makes me tremble? I mean, it's the basic things that she was singing in English. It's just slightly tweaked because it's in
just
French.
To make it rhyme.
Yeah, because, you know, nuit.
Yeah, kind of the reverse. Yeah, because I'm really the French singer Françoise Hardy. And, like, there are some translations of her songs into English where the content is pretty much the same, but they change the words to make them rhyme more. So, like, it seems like there's the reverse. You do that. I mean, that's a big thing that happens all over the world, which is ironically the song I was thinking, the Françoise Hardy song I was thinking of, which did Dans le Monde Entier, which was translated all over the world. It's pretty much the exact same message, but just like the words have changed to rhyme.
Well, thank you so much for being on the show. It's always great to talk to you. Yay!
Yeah, great to talk to you, especially about this song. I hope that more people take a liking to it and more people listen to it now, because it does not get the love it deserves. It's in my top 10 of hers, for sure. And, like, most people either are like, ew, that song kind of gross, or they forget about it. And I don't really know how they forget about it, because the vocals are just so powerful.
Mm-hmm.
But they do.
Yep. And I definitely agree on the voice. Oh, yeah. She really pushes herself.
Yeah, just the no control and, oh, he scares me. Like, those are just some of the best moments I've heard vocally from anyone.
And for somebody who uses her voice in so many different ways, that's saying a lot. Definitely.
Oh, yeah. Totally. She almost becomes spectral and ghost-like here. So I've compared it to Wuthering Heights a few times. I've noticed as I've been talking, and I think this song actually would, like, if you like Wuthering Heights, this is kind of along the same lines.
Mm-hmm. Well, she does. Kate Butch does like to become something otherworldly in a lot of her songs. Like, she's almost like she once tries to become the song. You know what I mean?
Right. Yeah, and in her performance style as well. Her dance movements are what she describes as she's dancing in a way that she feels embodies the song, where she's becoming the song, no matter how ridiculous it looks. So, endearingly ridiculous, I should say. So she just puts her all, and that's what I love about her vocalist, is just that you always believe that she believes what she's saying. And that's 100% true for this song. You hear all the conflict that the narrator is going through feels completely authentic, and she sells it 100%.
That she does.
Like, it is almost as if it's funny because it's a song about children who are possessed, but she almost sounds possessed by this character.
Yeah, and that's always her from the very beginning. Her style is like, if I'm going out on TV and I'm singing my song about Wuthering Heights, I am going to be like I'm going to be like Catherine Earnshaw.
Yeah, she's kind of, when you think about it, and this is looking forward to Houdini, but she in herself is almost a medium who channels so many different voices and so many different people just within her own in her own personhood. And this song, I think, is like an A-plus example of where just like the spirit of an entirely other being is coming through her, because this song has nothing to do with her life, has nothing to do with anyone's life. I mean, it's a fiction. It's not even something that, like, she would think about, I don't think, on a daily basis. The more I think about her as an artist, I think part of her artistry is the ability to be almost like this kind of channel and a medium who lets other voices and spirits come through her throughout her career.
If you have a favorite Kate Bush song, or even a couple songs that you'd like to talk about for a future episode, or you know something about this week's song that we didn't get to in our discussion, here's where you can contact me. You can find me either on Facebook, facebook.com/KateBushPodcast, on Twitter @StrangeKateCast, or on the web at kbcast.linkmedia.com. That's link with an E. Oh, and also there's email, kbcast@linkmedia.com. Again, that's link with an E. Join us next week for an episode about a very short track called Nights and at Stock. See everybody then. There was a singer in the 70s who was super popular. This part's probably going to get cut out. There was this popular singer in the 70s. His name was Claude François, and he was like a huge fan of Frank Sinatra. He basically wanted to be like the French version of Frank Sinatra. He did write a song that was the basis for My Way, actually. We listened to this in French class. It was called Comme d'habitude, which means as usual. And the content of that song.
You say it was in the 70s?
Oh, this was in the 60s. Claude François did this song called Comme d'habitude, which means as usual. And my French teacher showed it to us because he uses the past tense. And so he's talking about all these things that he did. And it's supposed to show a couple just going through the motions of their relationship, but it's deteriorating. And they're just doing everything as usual, as usual. What's up?
Not kind of like warm and soothing.
Okay. And yeah, basically like that. And Paul Anka or somebody, one of these songwriter guys, he heard Claude François singing this song on French TV while he was on vacation. And he said, oh my God, I love this melody. I need to put it to English so I can give it to Frank Sinatra. And then when he adapted it into English, they completely changed the content of the song. Like, they are the only things that those two songs have in common are the melody and the constant and the build up to the big climax at the end.
Interesting.
Yeah, like the two songs are completely different.
Yeah.
And then Claude François, like, part of his appeal was that he would take English language songs and then adapt them into French and sometimes completely change the content.
Interesting, because it's the normal practice to not do that. For example, you've probably heard of the famous French film composer Michel Legrand. Mm-hmm. And so, for example, the movie The Umbrellas of Cherbourg, which I hope you've seen.
Yes, I saw it in French 4. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Oh, awesome. So I love it. So the big song from that, I don't know the French title, but the American title is I Will Wait For You. And that, for example, that song, it... But like I actually have like I don't listen there. I have like three. It's performed like three times in the movie. I love that song so much. I have all three versions downloaded. I listen to them like I'm like a masochist. It makes me cry. So I'm like I'm just gonna make people cry.
I know it's a tragic movie. But, oh my god.
Yeah. Well, yeah. Well, that's a whole other discussion. But like, but basically, like, so that the lyrics to that. So basically, they took the she is saying in the song. It is about waiting for the boy to come back, but it was translated into English lyrics to say something like 4,000 summers, I'll wait for you. It's like, it's the same concept, but completely different lyrics. And it became a huge hit in America. And so generally Americans who know that movie are aware of it through that song, but it's actually, so it's the same melody and the same theme, but totally different lyrics. So she's not saying, there's no point to say like 4,000 summers, I'll wait for you, but that's the most famous line in the English version.
Oh,
but
it's
the same basic concept.
I will wait for you.
But so that was a pretty common thing.
Of je
ne pourrai. Yeah, I will wait for you, but if you've looked up, I can like email you like the scene in French. There's like the main scene where it first happens, then there's the final scene where I'm like gonna cry thinking of the final scene. But anyways, you can go back talking to me.
Yes, of course. I know that whole part is probably gonna get cut out, but you know, that's okay.
Hey, this is Liberty DeVito.
This is Mike Del Judas.
This is Michael Cavanaugh from Broadway's Moving Out.
This is John Jackson, director of the Billy Joel Archive.
This is Russell Javers.
This is Richie Cannata, and you're listening to Glass Houses, a Billy Joel podcast. It's awesome.
I'm Michael Grosvenor.
And I'm Jack Fernino.
We're lifelong Billy Joel fans who launched a podcast in 2020 celebrating the music we love.
Whether you're looking for the greatest hits or the B-sides and rarities, you'll find it all here. And if you've ever wondered what happens behind the scenes of a concert or recording session, we've got you covered.
Join us as we explore albums, tours, band members, the latest news, and more. You'll also get a unique glimpse into the music industry straight from the musicians and other professionals who help make it all happen.
Tune in to Glass Houses, a Billy Joel podcast, at glasshousespod.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
Glass Houses, a Billy Joel podcast, is a proud member of the Pantheon Podcasts Network.